Every Monday in December, we're looking back at the biggest science news of 2015, and today we're focusing on archaeology and paleontology. Our next guest says the theme for the past year is shaking up the family tree.
Gemma Tarlak is with us now to explain why. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, my fellow Homo sapiens.
Well, we are fellow Homo sapiens, but how we got to be that is looks a little different now than it did at the beginning of the year. How did we shake up the family tree in 2015?
Oh my gosh, it's been such an exciting time to be in paleoanthropology for so many reasons. Just take, for example, our top 10 this year, top 10 most significant science stories. Two of them are key developments in paleoanthropology. And the first one you probably heard about, it's our number two story of the year, Homo naledi, found in this crazy South African cave that was kind of, you know, up the stairs, down the stairs, under a little chute. It was almost impossible to get to this tiny little chamber. But when they did, they found it was just absolutely chock full of bones. They have found more than 1,500 fossils in that tiny little area, and they're nowhere near done excavating. It's the biggest hominin fossil find, the biggest early Homo fossil find ever. It's so exciting.
And we're going to talk more about those early hominids in February, but in the meantime, looking at the Homo naledi, this discovery, what are some of the big lingering questions that have yet to be answered there?
Well, as exciting as it is that they found so many fossils, they're having a real problem dating them because, you know, they found all these fossils from this one species that they're calling Homo naledi. And usually when you find a bunch of hominid fossils, you've got, you know, the femur of an extinct antelope or a rock layer that's really easy to identify when it was set down. So you can really easily date them. Well, not easy. Nothing is easy in paleoanthropology, but comparatively you can figure out pretty easily how old the actual fossils are. Unfortunately, in this chamber, there's no other material that they can use to base the date on. So they have to actually go in there and analyze chemical signatures of the fossils. It takes a lot longer. It's a lot trickier. So we have no firm date, which makes it really tantalizing. Where do these individuals fit in our family tree? We don't know.
This is one of the fun and frustrating things about science in general. You think, okay, we're going to make that next big discovery and it's going to answer our questions, when in fact, as we learned in this case, it often raises even more questions than we knew we had to begin with.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, on a side note, another scientist I was talking to about a story about the first farmers, he said his wife often asks him, hey, wouldn't you just want to go back in time and ask these people if they were intentionally sowing the seeds and harvesting them? And he said, no, that would take all the fun out of it. So, you know, it's one of the things that frustrates scientists, but it also keeps them so motivated.
Well, along these same lines, there's a story that you write about the oldest tools ever recorded. This is significant,
yeah,
too.
This is so tantalizing because, you know, we've got Homo naledi here, and it's a whole new species, no idea where it fits on the family tree. But we say to ourselves, oh, well, the genus Homo, to which we belong, as well as the Neanderthals, you know, we're all that. We're at the top of the food chain. We're the most advanced. We are the only tool makers around. If you're not a Homo genus member, you are not making tools. Well, this year, we found out that was a wrong idea. We found these tools, oldest stone tools ever. They're 3.3 million years old. Just for comparison, the previous oldest tools were 2.6 million years. So this is jumping way back, about 600,000 years. And that's before the Homo genus was around. That's before our genus was around. So we don't know if maybe we're wrong about how old the Homo genus is, or were the Australopiths, who we generally think are our direct ancestors, were they not as primitive as we thought? And were they capable of making these stone tools?
Well, speaking of resetting the human calendar, an old jaw piece found apparently belonging to our genus, Homo, and it could show that we were a lot older than we had previously thought.
Yeah, not quite old enough to make those tools. But, you know, there's this huge gap in the fossil record, roughly from about 2.4 million years all the way back to 3.0 million years, where we really don't have any clues as to that crucial transition period between the earlier Australopiths and our own genus, Homo. But they did find this mandible, it's a partial mandible, partial jawbone in Ethiopia that's 2.8 million years old. So it's right in the middle of that kind of gray area where we don't know what was going on evolutionarily. And they are pretty sure by the shape of the teeth, by the pattern, by the way they're placed in the jaw, the shape of the jaw, they're pretty sure it's Homo. They have not named the species yet because they just have this one partial jawbone, but it's something they're going to be looking at, and it suggests that, you know, we kind of think the Homo genus goes back about 2.6 million years, maybe. Maybe it's older. Maybe it goes back even further, starting with this 2.8 million-year-old jawbone.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlac right now from Discover Magazine. We're talking about the top science stories of the year. And again, this is an appetizer, Gemma. We're going to talk more about these early hominid fossils when we talk to you again in February. So we've been talking a little bit about maybe big questions, what it means to be human. And Chinese researchers have been editing human genes. And this has been an interesting story this year. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. And you know, this is a really intriguing thing because they're using a gene editing system called CRISPR-Cas9, and that has been around for more than a decade. Kind of it's continually refined, but what they did was they really crossed an ethical line that had never been crossed before that we know of. And these Chinese researchers took human embryos that were not viable. In other words, they would never have developed into fetuses. It was no way you could get a person born out of them. And they experimented trying to get rid of a hereditary blood disease by going in there, using the CRISPR system, changing the actual DNA in a way that had the individual been born and lived and procreated, the individual would have passed that genetic change on to its offspring. Now, this kind of research has been going on all the time for years in mice, in other lab animals, but there's always been this ethical line, like, we cannot do this with humans because that is opening a lot of doors that make people very uncomfortable, things like designer babies, just really absolutely changing really the foundations of our species and what it means to be human genetically. So that said, this experiment, which was released in April, they released the results. It was not successful, unfortunately. There were a lot of unintentional mutations introduced when they used the CRISPR system. So this is still very, very early work, but all the interest and all the discussion of the ethics involved spurred this entirely new way of looking and rethinking and basically saying, we are at a threshold. We need to get together, the international scientific community, and decide some rules, some regulations. And just last week, in fact, a three-day conference, international conference on gene editing wrapped up, and they're calling for more regulation. There's still a lot of debate whether they should be trying this at all on human embryos. But talking about the April experiment really kind of made people think, hey, this is not something we can put off till next year or the year after. This is something that's happening now. We need to get ahead of it and decide ethically what we want to do.
Another story where modern-day politics really is interacting with our human origins. ISIS and ISIL, of course, a great modern-day human toll, a lot of people dying. But also there's an archaeology angle, you write, in this top stories in science that we haven't heard as much about.
Yeah, and this is such a tragic story on so many fronts. But a longtime archaeologist, he's been an archaeologist in the Fertile Crescent area of Iraq and Syria for more than two decades. His name is Michael Dante, and he's now working with the State Department, figuring out ways of both preserving the incredible, incredible rich archaeological history and artifacts of the Iraq-Syria area, but he's also working on helping people document the destruction for future war crimes prosecutions. So really, ISIL, among, you know, they are horrible. They go in, they kill people, yes, but they are also raising, destroying, smashing a lot of priceless artifacts, and they are also selling them. They make a lot of money selling these things on the black market. And so by protecting our cultural heritage, protecting the cultural heritage of people living there in Iraq and Syria, it's really a way of protecting their identity, but it's also a way of cutting into the bottom line for ISIL and making it a little more difficult for them to finance their campaign of destruction.
And we're going to wrap up talking about, again, this has been an incredibly busy year in the archaeology field. What news are you expecting in 2016? There's some big stuff on the horizon.
Oh, yeah. I'm not just expecting it in 2016. I'm expecting it any second now. You know, I check my little cheat sheet alert box a couple times a day. But you may have heard that there's a British archaeologist who thinks he has discovered Nefertiti's tomb in the Valley of Kings. This would be huge because it's never been found, which means it may never have been looted. And he thinks it's actually hidden behind King Tut's tomb. And he has some really tantalizing clues about that, including just the shape of King Tut's tomb. It's actually the shape of a female pharaoh's tomb, which is kind of odd. And it's a little bit smaller than it should be based on his stature and his society standing. So they think actually it may be Nefertiti's tomb that they converted at the last minute and made it kind of a two-for-one tomb special and stuck King Tut in there too. So it could be absolutely huge because there's so much, you know, lore and legend about Nefertiti. But also, if we could find an unpillaged, unlooted tomb of an ancient Egyptian ruler, wow, right?
Yeah, and you're expecting that any day?
Yeah, they started. He mentioned his theory early in the year over the summer. The Egyptian government gave him permission to do some scanning, some non-invasive scanning. It was very positive. He thinks that it's more evidence supporting his theory. Basically, now they've got to go in invasively. And I'm sure they're not going to take like a sledgehammer to the tomb, but they're going to, you know, try to figure out if there are these fake doors or real doors that have been covered over with fake walls and stuff. And they're doing that right now.
Sounds incredibly exciting. You're going to keep us up on that. Gemma, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlek, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha.